welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Today is Monday, November 28th, 2016. On my left, Abe Greenwald, senior editor of the magazine. You can find him on Twitter, at Abe Greenwald. You can find, to my right, Noah C. Rothman, assistant online editor, at Noah C. Rothman on Twitter. I'm at J. Podhoretz on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook, at Commentary, and follow us on Twitter, at Commentary. Gentlemen, recounts. Suddenly we're back in recounts. 3 weeks after the election, and all we're talking about is recounts. Jill Stein, the lunatic head of the Green Party, the one who said that aliens are communicating to us through Wi-Fi, has raised $5 million to do recounts potentially in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, in order to ensure that the system was not hacked and that counties with electronic machines aren't more Trumpian than counties with paper ballots or Clintonian. And we have before us another example of the fraying of our civic culture, in which we are being told by the press and by the left and by people who are really unhappy with the result of the election that there may be a way out of this through the magical means of reversing a margin of 74 electoral votes. And in states in which the smallest margin that Trump won by was 10,000, there has never been a case in human history in which a recount of a tally has reversed a finding that a state won by 10,000 went actually to the other person. Every recount that we can think of, from the Florida recount in 2000 to the 2008 recount in Minnesota of the Senate election between Al Franken and Norm Coleman, these were states in which the margin was 300, 500, 600 votes, not 10,000 or 20,000 or 80,000 or whatever. Yeah, I can't remember what the margin is in Pennsylvania, but it's even larger than that, I believe. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us nothing except that over the weekend, something pretty untoward happened. Noah Rothman, can you tell us what that was?
Yeah, apparently an attorney for Hillary Clinton's campaign, which was dormant and now has sort of revved back to life, said that they were joining Jill Stein in this recount effort. And that sort of reverses all this coming to terms with which the left and America in general has been sort of struggling with over the last 3 weeks to accept and reconcile the election of Donald Trump to the presidency. That's been a tough thing for everybody to accept because the polls really didn't suggest that that was going to be the case. And Hillary Clinton, she conceded. A little reluctantly, but she conceded nevertheless. And this sort of throws a wrench in all those efforts. And as you said earlier, John, that the left in general is sort of toying with all these sort of fail-safe mechanisms and they can reverse the will of the voters. This is only going to further exacerbate tensions and make it harder to come to terms with Donald Trump.
Abe Greenwald?
Yeah, in fact, because the margins make it so preposterously unlikely to return a different result at this point, what happens when she loses again, when Hillary Clinton is now certified twice to be the loser, and Trump, for his part, is twice victorious? Are we going to go right back to sort of, you know, dealing with and trying to accept the election results all over again? Is there going to be a repeat of protests in the street?
Look, part of the point of these elections is that they not only take place and they herald a peaceful transition of power or the peaceful continuation of power in the hands of one person, but they provide a civic education for people in how the country works, which is complicated, and how, though we call ourselves a democracy, we're in fact a republic in which there are many efforts made to ensure that the direct mandate of the people is not reflected in how the country is governed. So we have the lesson every 4 years that we do not have a national election, but rather 50 state elections, and that the elections confer There is a winner-take-all, except in two states, there is a winner-take-all effect in everywhere that assigns not the vote, but electoral votes to a given candidate, and that the Electoral College then meets at some point 4 to 6 weeks after the election to formally choose the next president of the United States based on the state-by-state results. This is something that people learn every 4 years that they didn't quite understand. And it is a very important lesson in how the founders deliberately decided to make the paths to power in the United States complex ones, such that the same way that the Senate, as people learn and often to their dismay, is an undemocratic institution in the sense that it is not one person, one vote nationwide, because the vote of a person in Wyoming cast for one of, 800,000 people in Wyoming get two senators, and 41 million, 42 million people in California get two senators. Why was that? To ensure that the states had equal authority with each other, and that the more populous states or the more economically dominant states could not overpower the less economically dominant or populous states. And then, of course, the House of Representatives really is a one-man, one-vote system, and the Supreme Court, the third, is a lifetime appointment that goes through a process in which the public participates only very indirectly by choosing the senators who, but choosing the president who picks the nominee and the senators who advise and consent to the nominee's election to the court. So that's how we roll. And every time we have it, for the last 16 years, when there are problematic things that arise, we're now in a position where everybody questions whether or not this system is just. And it's functioned. We've had the most stable political system in the world now for 240 years. It looks like it's coming under immense pressure. Hillary Clinton did the right thing on November 9th. Barack Obama did the right thing. There is no evidence of systematic tampering with the vote or anything like that, according to every expert. Nonetheless, here we have it, and we have arguments being made that the Electoral College's choice should be reversed because the popular vote is going to Hillary Clinton, or because electors are supposed to make a moral decision on their own. Lawrence Lessig of Harvard and Peter Beinart of The Atlantic have both made this argument, which it would have been, I imagine they would just as easily have made had Hillary Clinton won and they had the same concerns about Hillary Clinton's character due to her mishandling of classified information and her use of the State Department as an ATM machine for her foundation. I'm sure they would have made the same argument against her choice by the Electoral College, which is why it proves that they're disingenuous and nonsensical. Having said all this, Donald Trump has not reacted to this in a way that fosters our civic culture either. Abe Greenwald, do you want to tell us what Trump has done?
Well, now Trump is saying that he, of course, would have won the popular vote if not for the millions of illegal votes. Votes by illegal aliens that worked against him. There's no evidence of this, obviously. One wonders why exactly he's doing this. Is it sort of just a sheer temper tantrum? Is it some sort of Steve Bannon-inspired mind game he's playing with his enemies to sort of, get them so blind with rage that they lose their footing? I don't know, but it's a terrible state of affairs, I think, for our civic culture. I mean, and what did Trump voters say in the week or so leading up to the election? The ones I spoke to at least said, "Oh, he'll win, but they won't let him have it." By the
right,
way,
they
yeah,
those illegal
right,
aliens,
right,
yeah, presumably.
Right. So yeah. now with the two sides poised to now go at it all over again. I mean, and just imagine what would happen if the Jill Stein effort returned this improbably different result. What kind of fraying that would do to our civic culture at this point?
Well, he said some very specific states that he lost as a result of these illegal alien votes, notably Virginia and North Virginia and New Hampshire, both of which have voter identification laws. So he's going sort of to war with this thing that has really become a galvanizing issue for the left, the idea of voter identification laws is tantamount to voter suppression, which, by the way, they haven't really been especially effective at, considering we had such a high turnout election in states like Virginia and North Carolina.
And by the way, 70 to 75% of the American people asked whether or not they support voter ID laws say they do.
Including minorities. But this is all kind of stupid, right? I mean, that suggests it's really dumb. So there was always going to be people who say, okay, yeah, he was robbed by illegal alien votes, even though there's no evidence for it. But most people, I would imagine, would hear the really cursory facts of the issue and say that this is stupid and makes no sense, and it's just Donald Trump trying to rile up people. As much as it's, you know, very scary for civic culture, I agree. It's something that's un-Republican, un-little r Republican, for the American president to behave in this fashion. It's also sort of, you know, assumes this, the lowest common denominator in intelligence level for the American public. I can't imagine most people hear this stuff and say, well, yes, clearly he was robbed.
But he wasn't robbed, so he won. So he's now invalidating. He's now suggesting that the election that he won was partially invalidated. So the winner says that our system is rigged, and the loser says maybe our system is rigged. So that's great. Congratulations. We now live under a rigged system. That was not supposed to be the case. At least if you won, you were supposed to say won fair and square.
That's Thanksgiving weekend in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a perfect end, I guess, in some sense, to the horrors of the last 2 years, you know, in which a sort of a, you know, clearly legally unfit dynastic candidate with exceptionally bad political instincts and, you know, sort of ran in one party and then Donald Trump ran in the other party. And we're sitting here. Nonetheless, Trump is going to have to make do with the fact that he lost the popular vote now by what is now approaching 2.5 million votes. Now, that is not how we decide who the president is. And if he wants to wander around saying that every one of those votes was an invalid vote, as my grandmother said, "Sei gesund" to him, that is would be a very foolish and stupid way to proceed. You know, he won 1% greater of the national vote than, or however my grammar is off there, but John McCain won 45.5%. Trump is now somewhere around 46.5%. So McCain losing an historic landslide to Barack Obama got 1%. Less of the vote than Trump did in winning. He needs to be cognizant of this fact and make his reckoning with the fact that he does not have a majority, he does not have a mandate. What he has is the institutional power of the Republican Party behind him, which is in a very strong position, but not that. It's a very strong position, strongest position that any party has been in from the local level to the presidency in 100 years or more, but he's only got a 4-seat margin in the House. It's going to be 52-48. He's got at least 2 or 3 senators who are very antipathetic toward him in the Republican Party. He's got the Democratic Party having to decide how it is going to deal with him, with the ability, by the way, to block him just as readily as the Republican Party blocked Obama from 2011 once it won back the House to 2016, if it should choose to do so by making it impossible for him to get anything through the Senate. So, you know, he has to reach out and do something about bringing people toward him so that he can make electoral coalitions to get legislation passed. And he wanders around talking about how he only lost because of illegal votes. That's not going to help him do that. And it's going to suggest a mindset in which many of his people are going to think that he should run roughshod over the country and, you know, sort of like force things through. And they're going to be back in the position they were complaining that the House and the Senate under Republican control couldn't get anything done because they were cucks. Right? So they couldn't get anything done because they were cucks. Well, so Democrats have the capacity to block everything in the Senate except judicial nominations and executive branch appointments under the current rule. So either they will have to destroy the filibuster in order to get things through, or he is going to have to figure out some way to make common cause. And he is going to have his own side looking to maybe think that he's a loser if he does that. And if he doesn't do it, he'll be a loser. So, he's got a complicated row to hoe. He's not going to make it any easier by getting into these dumbass fights.
Well, there's also Democrats in the Senate and the House who are, being sort of civically responsible, I suppose, and saying we're going to work with this new president in any way we can, and where we disagree, we're going to oppose him. But there are certain aspects of this, his agenda, that we can compromise on, and we're going to move forward with that. Now, I don't know whether or not the Democratic grassroots thinks that's preferable, even when it comes to just, big, massive infrastructure projects and the presumption that it, stimulates the economy. He's not going to be getting the approval for something like that through a Republican Senate, so it would be a compromise with the private sector. And any compromise with this president seems to be viewed from the liberal left as tantamount to rolling over for an aspiring despot. And why would they reward Democrats in the Congress for that sort of thing? I mean, we're looking very much through the looking glass version of 2009, where compromise...
Or 2011. Like, here's the
where
thing.
Where compromise with the executive from the other party is treasonous.
Now, in 2009, when Obama said, I won, and you don't get to write to say anything because I won, and then he got 60 votes in the Senate because Al Franken was finally certified as the senator... And he had this huge majority in the House, and he pushed through all this legislation, and the legislation went through, and Republicans said, we're not going to put our fingerprints on any of this. This is, you're going to own all of it. You are not, you don't want to talk to us, you don't want to go, you are going to own all of it, because they had no power. Democrats now have power. They can block any piece of legislation coming through the Senate. Republicans, as it turned out, played a very, very effective game with Obama, long-term game that Democrats didn't understand was being played, because by having left-wing legislation on healthcare, on the stimulus, on Dodd-Frank, on regulations and the auto bailout, if you put those all together, Republicans bore no responsibility for those, and those four pieces of legislation arguably brought the Democratic Party to its knees by 2016. Democrats are not in that position, because unlike 2009 and 2010, they can stop things from happening. At which point, Trump can say, I face an obstructionist Senate. Democrats are blocking me. Democrats can say, we need to block them still further. That's one approach to trying to win in 2018 and 2020. Or they can say, we tried to deal with him and he can't be dealt with. Or they can approve some of his legislation that's popular and try to save themselves from judgment by separating themselves from their party's national future by seeking to make him an unpopular and unsuccessful president. They're going to have to hit on one or another strategy, because you can't do one of, there's no way to do one of three at once. The Republican strategy was a strategy of weakness. That is, how can we do best in a position of extreme weakness? If Obama had, in 2011, this is, again, what if counterpositives, if Obama had looked at the election of 2010 the way that Bill Clinton looked at the election of 1994 and said, I went way too far, and the public has handed its hat to me, and I better figure out some ways in which I can still tag the Republicans for irresponsible and horrible behavior, but work with them on other stuff. So on the one hand, he blamed Republicans and Rush Limbaugh for the Oklahoma City bombing, and on the other hand, and the government shutdown, and on the other hand, he passed welfare reform in 1996. And basically, they started moving toward the deal in 1997 that led to a balanced budget. Obama looked at 2011 and said, I'm doing nothing different. You're all a bunch of lunatics, and I'm going to say you're lunatics, and I'm going to do whatever I can to stop you. And it was fine, because he got himself reelected in 2012, and then they lost the Senate in 2014, and he will be succeeded by Donald Trump as president, who will undo Obamacare and likely undo the Iran deal and leave him with no legacy whatsoever, except being the first black president.
But the Democrats here have a tough needle to thread, because if they work with him on the types of things that their voters would approve of, infrastructure and changing the status of our free trade, they sort of begin to take away a bit of their reason for existing. Right. If he's putting through their big items.
Well, Noah Rothman, let's ventilate on that a little bit, because this is one of the questions we were talking about earlier before we taped, or when we failed to tape our first version of this. This is our second version because we failed to plug something into the wall.
I think it's stronger.
Good. But we were talking about how the Democratic Party finds itself in a unique position because it now has to rebuild it thought that it had a winning coalition, and its theory of why it was a winning coalition turned out to be wrong, and now they are going to have to figure out how to go forward.
Well, again, reaching back to that conversation that we had, which was really good. You should have been there. One of the things that was bizarre, and I'm borrowing from you, John, from Hillary Clinton's approach to this campaign, was that she felt very comfortable in saying, you know, outright, clearly, and without apology, that she was going to bankrupt a core industry in the American industrial heartland, the coal industry, and a lot of the energy sector with it. And that
she bragged about it to get votes. She bragged about it to environmental voters to get votes.
Right, but very
she bragged about it. She didn't say it, you know, in private, like Obama said, all my rivals are bitter clingers, you know, hang on to their guns and their religion. She said it publicly to try to, you know, because she thought it was a winning argument.
Well, it's a winning argument if your coalition is based on the quote-unquote coalition of the ascendant, which is Barack Obama's winning coalition. Minorities to the tune of, you know, 95 to 98% of the black vote, and at least 65% of the Hispanic vote, young women, unmarried women, and students and young people, again, to ridiculous margins. So if you got those voters, if you got Barack Obama's voters, it doesn't matter what happens in Appalachia or the Mountain West or any of these places that you don't have to really worry about white voters. But if you have to worry about white voters, then it doesn't work out. So now the Democratic Party is trapped between committing itself to this identity politics, this approach to balkanizing the electorate, which has worked so well for Barack Obama, but for nobody else, and they sort of don't have any other idea as to how to approach the electorate, or the idea that the party needs to go back to its sort of New Deal roots. And that's, you know, in the high-minded sectors of liberal society, we're seeing that debate play out, but we're not really seeing that from where the energy and enthusiasm is coming from the left. We're seeing kookery and just, you know, rending of garments hysteria over the prospect of Donald Trump's ascendancy. We're not really seeing very much intellectual engagement with the idea that we lost this electorate and how do we win again.
Well, and they're not really sure of the way forward either, because there is something of a culture war going on the left now between these two groups, you know, between the working class whites and this new class of identitarians.
Right. Well, you know, one of the interesting aspects of the New Deal coalition that was in the ascent, was the core of the Democratic Party's appeal until Barack Obama, was that it was the little guy party. It was the little guy versus the big guy party, with the possible exception of small business. It was soak the rich, you know, speak for the working class guy, speak for the, you know, speak for the poor immigrant, speak for the poor African American, such that you could have a coalition of Southern segregationists and Northern African Americans electing politician after politician and keeping the House in Democratic hands for, you know, 40 uninterrupted years from 1954 to 1994. Something changed here, which is that Obama led, I think, offered a great temptation, which was the idea that that coalition was over with and it could be supplanted by a sort of new class coalition that Noah described, sort of minorities, African Americans, Latinos, young unmarried women, young people, students, and, you know, anyone who was part of a hyphenate, you know, a sort of a gay American, LGBT person or something like that. Well, it was an interesting theory. It got Obama elected in large measure because he got this overwhelming African American vote that not only turned out for him in margins that no one had ever seen before, but in percentages that no minority had ever voted for president before. And the problem is that it all presumed that the day of the white voter had somehow passed. And it turns out the day of the white voter has not yet passed. And when you spend 40 years balkanizing the American electorate, a politician coming along essentially appealing to the white voter as a white voter might have some purchase. And so, you know, the white voter only now makes up 71 to 72% of the electorate. That's still 71 to 72% of the electorate. It's not 48% of the electorate. We're a generation away from that yet. And I think a lot of us bought into the idea that it was all coming on so fast. And, you know, it may have been we thought that it was coming on so fast because the social changes that Barack Obama and his coalition wrought came on so fast that we were all sort of punch drunk and dizzy. Like, you know, we don't know now what the effect, let's say, of the gay marriage decision of the Supreme Court might have been in creating the world in which Obama says we're also politically correct. We can't, you know, it's time for us not to be so politically correct anymore. Well, maybe there's a whole lot of people in this country who didn't like that decision who do not have the vocabulary to talk about it because all that ever happens is that they're called bigots or racists. But they voted on it. They won't tell pollsters that that's why they voted on it. They won't tell anybody that's why they voted on it, but they voted on it. They didn't like hearing that bakers were being sent to jail or being fined because it was against their faith to bake a cake for a wedding, for a gay wedding. I mean, we don't know is the point, but what we also did, what I think we have learned is that the future is not here yet. And I think we were all, a lot of us were sort of gulled into believing that the inevitable demographic alteration of the United States had already taken place, and it had not. Now, having said that, it is important to note, as I began, that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. This is now six out of seven elections in which the Democrat has won the popular vote. This country remains more Democratic than Republican, and it remains more liberal than conservative. Donald Trump won in part by running as a liberal, not as a conservative, or as a sort of, as Noah once said, a revanchist Democrat, supporting things like, industrial policy and protectionism, which were the shibboleths of the 1980s Democrats. So we don't know, you know, that doesn't mean that there's been some ideological shift to the right here. Far from it. Which is why Trump may have an opening, or should in theory have an opening with some of these Democrats to make cross-party coalitions were he not Donald Trump, were he not a divisive figure who culturally is so anathematic to everybody in the new class coalition that was Obama's coalition that it would be very hard for them to make any kind of common cause without being considered betrayers of the future, of the minority, of our future as a country that isn't you know a Hitlerite dictatorship.
Yeah, it's particularly true because Democrats who have begun to engage in the "how do we rebuild" argument seem pretty much inclined to double down on what they've been doing. It was I'm reaching back to pre-14, I think, but it was Sean Trende who did a real pretty in-depth study, multi-part study on the shift in voting patterns in regions, finding things like the upper Midwest shifting towards Republicans slightly, the Mountain West shifting towards Democrats slightly, but the real dramatic shifts has been in places that could be considered Appalachia. The mountain terrain running from northern Pennsylvania down through Arkansas. And that, you know, 20 years ago was pretty reliably Democratic on the local level and even the presidential level, at least in the 90s, and has radically shifted towards Republicans over the course of this 20 years, the same voters. So now those guys can be kind of dismissed if you're one of these identitarian Democrats because of the fact that they're sort of electorally not distinguished, not really substantial on the electoral college level, but also culturally backward, and the perception, as at least from the urbane liberal class, the limousine liberal class in the coasts, and so that could be sort of sacrificed and given up to Republicans. That was the focus of Thomas Edsel's New York Times column in 2011, which had the New Deal Democrats freaking out they were giving up on the white working class. And some Democrats, or at least you have this engagement, at least in the House, in the form of Ohio Representative, Democrat Representative Ryan's challenge to Hillary Clinton, saying, you know, we need to be an industrial middle class party.
Nancy Pelosi, Tim Ryan, who is running for the House Minority Leader position against Nancy Pelosi, who has been the leading Democrat in the House since 2005, and was the House Majority Leader. Until from 2011.
But there's also, just to finish the point, is that there's also the sort of the intellectual class of the liberal left that wants to really double down on this identity politics argument. And I cite Jamail Bowie, who writes from the left for Slate, who wrote today that the future of the Democratic Party is to follow in the footsteps of Jesse Jackson's 1984 Rainbow Coalition style. And he said, you know, that this, I mean, that sounds on its face to be sort of silly, because that was a very ill-fated venture that forced the Democratic Party to sort of rethink its nominating process entirely to make sure that no Jesse Jackson ever won the nomination. But he cites Bill Clinton, who ran in 1992 as sort of a centrist Democrat with the idea that they would sort of divorce themselves from the Jimmy Carter style liberalism of Jimmy Carter and then Mondale and Dukakis, and that the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, that was sort of a centrist vehicle, wasn't as much an ideas vehicle as it was an identity politics vehicle, but only...
That's Bowie's argument.
Through which white grievance politics and identity politics could be practiced in a more acceptable fashion that was sort of sub rosa and only identifiable to people who are well-versed in
this sort of notion. If I could just break in before Abe makes his point... this is one of these anachronistic things where you're talking about the past from the lens of the present. So there is now an idea that because Bill Clinton was a tough on crime guy and passed the crime bill in 1994, and, you know, Hillary Clinton talked about super predators in 1996, that he was a Democrat at war with African Americans. And this is insane, because the fact is that Clinton took over in 1993. And what he didn't know and what no one knew was that we were about to hit, and in part because of the crime bill, which played a role in this, we were about to hit a historic war against crime that was successful. And so for 20 years now, we basically lived in a low crime world after 30 years of living in sort of utter urban lawlessness, and except for pockets like Chicago, which is undergoing a giant gang war, in a pocket of Chicago where there are many murders, although if you go, you know, 5 miles in the other direction, you'd never have any idea that anything untoward was going on in Chicago. So Bill Clinton came in. One of the reasons Democrats could never win the presidency and were the party sort of like in the shadows was because they had nothing to say about crime, and Clinton said something about crime. Now, talking about crime to Jamail Bowie is a war on African Americans, and that is just a historical illiteracy on his part. You know, whether or not you think that the successful prosecution against the crime wave, you know, led to an excessive incarceration of African American males and stuff like that, the fact is that everybody in the country was, you know, living in a state of fear everywhere. There was no escape from crime unless you put up a gate in front of your house with a, you know, and had a guard at the front of it. And now we're in a position where a successful effort to move the Democratic Party to the center is now viewed and is preached against as a, you know, as a war on black people and a form of white identity politics. And if that's the way Democratic and liberal intellectuals want to go, they will happily go in that way until they never win the presidency or the House or the Senate ever again.
Yeah, I think this points to one of the failures of liberal identity politics, which is an intellectual failure, which is that liberals are operating on their conception of identity, of these identities and their concerns and what they want. And it may not have as much basis in reality as they've been supposing it does. I also think that it's partially what makes all this talk of doing away with the Electoral College particularly distasteful. If Barbara Boxer got her way, and if we rid ourselves of the Electoral College, then they could double down on identity politics, because on identity politics and on politics, and they can just say, "We now officially forget Appalachia. This is we will now just focus on these population centers, and we will win on popular vote."
Look, one of the interesting things that was said to me by an intellectual Buchananite in the 1990s was that America is like Europe. America and Europe are very similar, because there are economic wars inside the United States. Like if oil goes down in price, it hurts Texas, but it helps, New York. So therefore there are regional variances. It's just that everyone lives under the same currency and has the same, and sort of has this fantasy that they're all Americans. And it's not a fantasy. It's actually the case. And if you actually broke down the Electoral College, such that Trump himself, in this weird way of being this kind of candide, like innocent, who never really thought that deeply about politics, said, because of this, because I had to win 270 electoral votes, I went to places I wouldn't ordinarily have gone. I spent a lot of time there. I went to Wisconsin. I went to Ohio. I went to Maine's second congressional. I spent some time in New Hampshire. I had to go to the South. Like, I had to go to these places. Florida, I spent a lot of time in Florida anyway. But, and I met all these people, and I heard all this stuff, and I wouldn't have heard it otherwise, because I would have been attempting to maximize the popular vote by going to New York and California and Illinois and Florida and Texas and Colorado, places that are the most populous, where you can get the more bang for your buck, and if he could have gotten 5 million more votes in California than he got, or 3 million more, this popular vote margin would no longer be there. And it's an interesting thing, because this is not just whether he does sort of celebrity tour, poverty tourism. It is that the country is based on the idea that there are regional differences, state-by-state differences, and that the president of the United States is in a unique position because he is the only one who is required by our system to represent all of them. Everybody else who is elected in this country represents, congressmen represent localities, senators represent states, the president represents everybody, and he builds a national coalition. He can't win everybody, but he carves together a national coalition that makes him the governor of everyone.
It's a particularly interesting thing, because normally the idea that direct votes are being mediated by the Electoral College, that's historically a sort of kind of elite sort of notion about watering down public opinion, but in fact, or sort of mediating or
the popular will.
The popular will. But in fact, what's happening now is the calls to get rid of the Electoral College and go to a popular vote would in fact have the effect of elevating elite coastal and city opinion to the disfavor of the larger country.
With the exception of, I guess, Maine and Nebraska now, and it sort of goes back and forth every cycle, but the first-past-the-post system that we have in these states, where you get past the post, you're a majority or plurality winner, you win the whole state, that's anti-Madison. Madison wanted plurality electoral votes in all states and communities, which would have been a disaster for Hillary Clinton, because she won fewer than 500 counties
out of 3,309 counties.
Right, so she has a very modest, really poor allocation, inefficient allocation of Democratic votes, and that's what they're sort of failing to reconcile. Understandably, I suppose, because you have people in places in states like Rhode Island that are saying, we're going to now undermine the Electoral College by passing laws that will force our electors to vote the way of the national vote, which you can do. There's nothing illegal about it, per se, but it's very anti-Republican, Republican.
By the way, but going back to Jamel Bowie and the, Rainbow Coalition, Hillary Clinton lost this election by 200,000 votes in these three states. It's not that big a pull for Democrats to get 200,000 votes in these three states, particularly if they're running up these large margins elsewhere. The idea of doubling down on the philosophy that led them to lead an opening to break the electoral, the blue wall, you know, of the Democratic Party by like doubling down on it so that you harden some of this into orthodoxy as opposed to chipping away at it a little bit here and there is crazy. I mean, it isn't that big a pull. Obama won two, you know, he destroyed the party, but like it's not going to be, he's out, someone else will be running in 2020. For all we know, Hillary will run in 2020. She just won 65 million votes. Like, you know, people were talking about Romney running again in 2012. I mean, I know she's I think she's a lousy candidate, but, you know, whatever. You can still go back and win them unless you hew to the philosophy that, you know, the country is so balkanized that you don't have to speak to white people if you're a Democrat. It's just stupid. I mean, there's no point to it except that you don't, except that the wish is father to the thought. You don't want the party to represent any form of the old-fashioned America. You want it to be the future America, the America in which there are no, either there are no labels or all you are is labels. That's the comic point about this, right? Was once we had this fantasy of kind of a miscegenated America in which no one would be judged for any reason except individually. And now we've moved from that liberal leftist fantasy into the leftist fantasy that everybody should be judged and everything should be determined by your skin color and by your, you know, ethnic loyalties and your loyalty to whatever sexual preference, you know, whatever sexual urges you might have. And those are supposed to override everything else, including your economic interests and what's best for your children and whether or not your streets are safe and whether or not things are clean and the sorts of things that we need government for, like, which is to pick up the garbage and mostly, in the federal sense, to provide for the common defense, not to make us all feel good and not to, like, run common core education systems and not to, you know, impose, you know, not to buy, you know, buy off carrier so that it won't move its plant overseas. It's to provide for the common defense and to, you know, keep, regulate interstate commerce and about four other different things. And if you want to play this game, go ahead. The game, that the demographic game favors Democrats without question, but the atomization game may well favor Republicans if they become the white party. If, you know, whites overwhelmingly vote for the Republican Party until whites become a minority majority in 25 years, they'll win every election.
Well, there's a warning here in for Republicans in looking too aggressively, I guess, at Donald Trump's coalition and thinking it's their coalition. Because that was what the trap that Democrats fell into. Democrats convinced themselves that Barack Obama's coalition was their coalition. It wasn't. Not one Democrat benefited from Barack Obama's coalition, but Barack Obama, with maybe the exception of a couple of senators who wouldn't be senators but for running in 2012. I'm thinking specifically of North Dakota's Heidi Heitkamp. But, you know, very, very few others benefited from Barack Obama on the ticket. A lot of Republicans benefited from Donald Trump being on the ticket, but he's not going to be on the ticket again in 2 years, and maybe not in 4 years. Donald Trump's coalition is Donald Trump's coalition. He ran, as we said earlier, a revanchist, populist, nationalist Democrat who promised to bring industrial, heavy industry back to the Midwest, which is not going to happen. You don't see very many Republicans exceptionally eager to run on or even enact Donald Trump's policies. They seem to be leaning towards tax code reform and entitlement reform and sort of dragging their feet on stuff like the wall and protectionism and all the other things that Donald Trump drew applause on the trail from. Lock her up. That's over. So we don't really know whether or not we have a Donald Trump party here. We have a conservative party with a populist sort of revanchist Democrat who very attuned to white identity politics at its head.
Abe Greenwald?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if Lock Her Up is now actually revived in light of Hillary's support for the recount and Trump going on Twitter. And
it might be. That was very, very mean of her. I was very generous and gracious.
Yeah. Now, I would like to say, by the way, that once again, we're in a position where Trump has largely gone silent except for these weird tweets. And we don't know what he's going to do on policy. You know, his cabinet choosing has gone from and the White House selection process has sort of turned into a crawl. You know, he's got his business conflict of interest stuff to worry about. And, you know, he's not talking about policy. We have no idea what he's going to do when he gets into office. We have no idea anything. That will alter everything. Everything that we're talking about now, once again, either relates to the election or what happened in the election or what might happen. And none of it has any meat on the bones because we don't know what he is going to attempt to do. And we are starving for some clue because, you know, we haven't had a personalized presidency like this practically ever. I mean, you know, maybe Eisenhower a little bit, you know, none of us was alive to see that. So I can't really speak to that. Speaking of the personalized leadership and the horror of it and the nightmare of it, of course, Fidel Castro passed into the other world on Saturday at the age of 90 or Friday night at the age of 90, occasioning celebrations in Miami from Cuban exiles and the satisfied sense that some form of justice had been done for everyone who knows anything about the horrors visited upon the island nation of Cuba and its people over the last 56 years, 57 years. And yet an outpouring of emotion and support from the Prime Minister of Ireland, the Prime Minister of Canada, the Secretary General of the UN, the head of the EU, all of whom seem to celebrate Castro's example, and the President of the United States, who said nothing in his report on the death of this 20th century totalitarian monster, but that, you know, he supported the Cuban people in their time of need and grief and hope they could move forward.
I wrote on Twitter at the day, about 12 hours after the announcement, that any administration that wasn't so ideologically committed to rehabilitating Havana would take this opportunity, this moment of great cultural shift, and catalyze a revolution in Cuba, and say the call for a Cuban spring, and say this is an opportunity for the Cuban people to rise up and to take back their country. And not only have we didn't see that, but we saw a lot of liberals echo the exact same sentiments that we saw liberals echo in the 1980s when they said Ronald Reagan was too antagonistic toward the Soviet Union, that there's a time and place for that sort of thing, and it's counterproductive to do that now. What you want to do is lean back, look kind of deferential and unattached, and whatever you do, don't give this this regime any excuse to say, well, they're the bad guys, they're responsible for your lots in life, and look at them now, they're trying to catalyze some sort of revolution and spill blood in the streets. They're the people you should be blaming, and it was wrong in the 80s, and it's wrong today.
Abe Greenwald?
You know, Barack Obama is now reassuring himself with the idea that, look how right I was to normalize relations with Cuba. I'd said this was a long-dead Cold War, and Fidel Castro is dead. This is
amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing of him
yes.
to have, you know, seen the possibility that an 89-year-old right. man might die in his 90th year or 91st year on Earth.
In his defense, nobody thought Castro was going to die. Ever.
Ever, right. Okay. Well, you know, someone went up and dug up Gerald Ford's statement on the passing of Mao, which was similarly ideologically contentless and sent greetings or condolences to the Chinese people in hopes that they would move forward and all of that. So I'm glad that at the end of his career as the President of the United States, Barack Obama is echoing the detente-ish, anti-ideological, anti-freedom, you know, messages of, you know, of the tail end of the Ford administration, which it may well join in the ranks of the least consequential administrations ever if, in fact, Donald Trump comes in and gets rid of Obamacare and the Iran deal. Speaking of Donald Trump, of course, he showed up the president by making his first, I think, unambiguously, properly morally framed and powerful statement about Castro's passing, that he was a tyrant who had enslaved millions and who had trampled on human rights, and that now it was time for Cuba possibly to find the freedom that it had long been denied. I want to close by saying one thing about Cuba and the oddity that we face, that this tiny country of 11 million people, you know, with an economy the size of a postage stamp, still occupies some kind of central place in the, you know, minds and thoughts of the West, which is that when Castro took over on New Year's 1959, it was 18 years since Pearl Harbor, since an attack on the American fleet, killing 1,500 people and you know, and destroying half of our fleet and air force in the Pacific. That was an American property. Remember, Havana is 90 miles from Miami. 2 years or and Castro was a client of the Soviet Union. Cuba was a client state of the Soviet Union 2 years earlier. Sputnik had been launched, thus threatening the possibility that the skies above the Earth were going to be dominated by the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union, with nuclear weapons, had a client 90 miles offshore. Doesn't take an intercontinental missile to fire a missile at America, a nuke 90 miles. And so the threat from Cuba was very, very real. And we know it was real because we know from an interview that Castro gave to Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic 2 years ago, that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Castro openly advocated that Nikita Khrushchev nuke the United States. That was his stated wish and policy. Of course, did not happen, but that means that the dictator of the island 90 miles from the United States was, in fact, interested in its annihilation. And that is why it occupied a dominating position in the cultural and political life of the United States for so long, and why it should not be viewed as anything less than a moment of great satisfaction that the monster who enslaved millions and had 10% of the population in prisons and enslaved every and tortured homosexuals and poets and writers and everything like that has now met his maker. Noah?
Yeah, and one of the, you know, reaching back, we were talking about, you know, why this communist dictator has captured the hearts of the global liberal left in a way that other communist dictators sort of never did. Like, you don't, the Kim dynasty just doesn't really, you know, ratchet up the enthusiasm of the global left. And part of that
the Soviets never, after the 1930s, the Soviets never did either.
Yeah, and part of that might be the fact that that sort of their revolutionary doctrine was much more Lenin's revolutionary doctrine. Insofar, it sort of, you know, you had to organize politically before you could have a communist revolution. And Castro exported revolution violently, exported military insurgencies in places like El Salvador and Guatemala and Angola, where, by the way, American troops faced each other and Cuban troops faced each other in Latin America. So he sort of he was much more an activist, anti-Western, anti-American force than the Soviets and the PRC and even the DPRK came to be, which sort of viewed capitalism as this thing that would inevitably collapse. Castro viewed it as something you needed to confront and fight and eventually destroy on the battlefield.
Abram Wald, you said something earlier about the talk of the wonderful things that Castro did with Cuban literacy and healthcare.
Yeah, there was a lot of that coming out yesterday. That he made great advances in Cuban literacy and their healthcare system. This has long been a topic for people like Michael Moore, who in his documentary take I believe American soldiers down to Cuba to be treated by their supposedly more responsive and wonderful healthcare system. The point to me, not that we can, even if we pretend that we believe the figures that Cuba provides on these issues, the point to me is that Castro is a man who imprisoned an island nation. He turned it into a prison, and then you have people praising him for helping the prisoners learn how to read. To me, that is positively perverse.
Yeah, it's also balderdash because the country had the highest literacy rate in Latin America when he took over. And literacy is a contagion. Let's say if once half the population is literate, the other half becomes literate because people teach their children how to read. So that was something that he did not do. And as you mentioned, the only healthcare stats we have in Cuba are provided by the Cuban government. There's no reason to believe that they're, you know, accurate. And one thing we know is that it's not as though leaders from the communist world were flocking to Havana to get themselves medical treatments when they got sick. That didn't happen either. So Castro is dead. Barack Obama made a shameful statement. Donald Trump made a good statement, thus proving that 2016 still has the capacity to surprise us and also tragically to remind us of the horrors that can be perpetuated as we note the dreadful shooting on the campus of Ohio State University, the causes of which and the details of which are only just now coming across the wire. So that brings us to the end of another Commentary Magazine podcast. Commentary, now in its 72nd year, is the foremost intellectual, cultural, and analytical monthly of conservative ideas. Please join us at commentarymagazine.com. 1995 gets you a full year after some free reads of reading everything, and 2995 gets you everything plus our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox. So please join us. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.